I've been lonesome, and I've been aching, and I've been yearning. Scratch this itch, leave this town, sweet mama now.
Hello and welcome to your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill and this is the Red Satin programme for Saturday, the 23rd of May 2020.
And I've run so long that I've forgotten.
I do hope you're all well and staying safe in these rather unusual times. As you know, we're no longer sending out USB sticks, but asking our listeners to tune in to Radio Verulam on 92.6 FM on Thursdays at 7 p.m. for some of our local news stories and the radio listings. This longer version will always be available on our website, and this week, alongside the news stories and radio listings, we have Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes and a couple of articles from Hearts Life magazine, one about the Church's Conservation Trust, and the other, the remarkable story of Thomas Stevens, who cycled around the world in the 1880s on a penny farthing. The music this week is a song called 40 Miles, written and performed by local singer Dan Raza, who has kindly allowed us to use it. As usual, I'll play it in full at the end of the programme. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Hilary, Sue, Caroline, Jilly, Sarah, Ian and Rob.
Hello, this is Hilary. In my first story, the paper asks, with Luton Airport struggling in wake of the pandemic, is expansion still viable? Luton Borough Council has recently asked central government for a £50 billion emergency revenue fund as it anticipates a loss in airport revenues of around £45 million in 2020-2021 as a result of the coronavirus. This, combined with the enforced changes made to the way people work as a result of the coronavirus, begs the question, is the proposed expansion to add a second terminal appropriate or viable? Labour High Town Councillor Andy Malcolm has said, COVID-19 is and will continue to decimate airport passenger numbers, with the operator currently forecasting a reduction of at least two-thirds in 2020-2021. Our current estimates suggest an income loss of around £45 million for London Luton Airport Limited. This will remove the ability to pay a dividend over the next 2 years. When taking into account the expected reduction in business rates, council tax, rents, fees and charges, this will result in a shortfall of about £49 million in the council's budget for 2020-21. London Luton Airport Limited, which owns Luton Airport, ran a statutory consultation between October 16, 2019 and December 16, 2019 for Hertfordshire residents and surrounding counties living under the flight path. Following this, the company was expected to submit a development consent order application to the Planning Inspectorate next month. However, it has now been postponed as a result of the virus. It said on its website, the COVID-19 pandemic is having a major impact on the aviation industry. Our focus during these unprecedented times is firmly upon supporting staff and all our partners across London Luton Airport and preparing for a period of recovery. Following our statutory consultation during the autumn, we're considering very closely and seriously the feedback we received as we continue to prepare for a development consent order application. As businesses are forced to take to video chat platforms such as Zoom, the business trip abroad is arguably set to become a thing of the past, even when the skies reopen. This, along with other difficulties faced by the industry, has prompted campaigners against the expansion to question its viability. Speaking for residents groups Ladakan, which fights to reduce airport noise and environmental impact, Andrew Lamborn said, despite the current expansion project not having delivered the noise reductions promised and hence breaking its planning conditions, Luton Airport owners, led by Robin Porter, Luton Borough Council CEO, pressed ahead last year with a proposed development consent order to double the capacity yet again. This has already cost the people of Luton £40 million, which is sorely needed now just to make ends meet as a result of the COVID crisis. So he's asking for a government bailout of £50 million. This already risky project, originally estimated to require £4 billion investment, now looks untenable given the likely contraction in aviation, as people realise not only it's one of the biggest contributors to carbon emissions, but also that practising social distancing in an airport and on a plane in close proximity to others is extremely difficult. We're calling on Luton Airport to focus on being a better airport, showing how environmental impacts can be reduced over time rather than increased, rather than always trying to be a bigger airport. Councillor Anna Brewster, Harpenden Rural County Councillor and Vice Chairman of Luton Airport Consultative Committee, said, "Whilst clearly I support economic growth, the pre-COVID-19 idea to double airport passengers numbers was already excessive, with absolutely no mitigation offered to the Hertfordshire communities already negatively affected on our roads, on our trains and noisy, very low altitude flying above our heads. There now needs to be a complete government rethink about UK aviation, so I would be deeply shocked and disappointed if the planning application is still submitted to grow the airport."
Hello, I'm Sue. Following the public consultation last autumn, London Luton Airport was set to submit its application for the expansion in June this year. Chief Strategy Officer Graham Oliver said, "We've gone away to take a fresh look at every aspect of sustainability and the impacts of running an airport, and are actively considering how we can set out on a path that would make London Luton one of the most sustainable as well as socially conscious airports in the UK. We are serious about this, and it is right that we take all the time we need at this stage. We won't be submitting our DCO application in June, as originally outlined, and we hope to have much more to say about this over the coming weeks and months. Since 2013, our ongoing investment in the airport has delivered a £21 million yearly increase in revenue to the council and significantly offset the need for harder cuts to vital frontline services in Luton. In response to concerns which have been heightened by the coronavirus outbreak, Luton Airport and Luton Borough Council have acknowledged the difficulties aviation faces, but said the country's airports will play a big role in getting the economy back on its feet. A Luton Airport spokesman told this newspaper, "London Luton Airport is a key driver for the economy in beds, hearts and bucks, and like all airports, it will play a pivotal role in getting the country back up and running once the outbreak is finally contained. We continue to adapt to the changing situation, remaining open for those with an essential need to travel. Our cargo operation is also enabling delivery of vital supplies, including medical equipment for the NHS, while our midterm car park is being used as a COVID-19 testing centre as part of the government's UK-wide programme to control the spread of the coronavirus. With the right level of support from the government, LLA will be at the heart of the region's revival, playing its part in ensuring that the UK emerges on the other side of the crisis stronger than before." Graham Oliver, Chief Strategy Officer for Luton Council's airport company, London Luton Airport Limited, said COVID-19 has sadly impacted on every area of people's lives and well-being, and the effects on aviation have been stark. "We are an airport owner entirely focused on supporting and improving people's lives and driving economic and employment growth, both in Luton and neighbouring communities. We see it as vital that we work hard not only to support safe passenger services at Luton, but also continue to plan for how prudent investment in our stewardship of the airport can continue to benefit future generations. This will be vital for supporting the local, regional and national recovery that will need to take place after the pandemic. Since our second public consultation late last year, we have been listening carefully to feedback about our proposals for long-term expansion, and in particular a clear message that people want us to go even further to mitigate environmental issues, including noise, air quality and climate change."
Hi, I'm Gilly. Woman at risk dies in flat blaze. A vulnerable woman died in her burning St. Albans flat after her neighbour's claim, pleas to provide mental health support, went unheard. The woman, who was in her 40s, became trapped in the blaze at Bowgate on Hillside Road at around 6:30 p.m. on Friday, after a cigarette is believed to have set light to her sofa. Children were screaming as the smoke and flames engulfed their neighbour's property, and their panicking parents tried to take them to a place of safety. Police and fire attended the scene, and the woman was pronounced dead shortly afterwards. Residents say support services had previously been asked to help the tenant, but their requests fell on deaf ears. Emma Kenchington, 30, who lived in the same block, said, "We have been trying to get help for this poor woman for the last 21 weeks since she moved here. My carbon monoxide alarm went off and I had to get everybody out." Neighbour Kirsty Swery Suska said, "We have spent 6 months trying to get Home Group to do something about the situation. They never listened. She was completely failed by them and our safety was put at risk. We all have children who are now suffering after the traumatic experience of seeing this tragedy." Another resident, Ellie Tully, said, "I feel that housing and mental health teams should have done more so that this did not result in tragedy." And neighbour Hayley Dirda said, "I believe that the woman in question needed more support and has been failed." Head of Service Delivery for Housing Association Home Group in the South, Joe Huxtable, said, "We are truly saddened by the tragic event which took place last Friday. All of our thoughts are with our customers' family at this time. We were aware that some residents had concerns for our customers' well-being. That is why we were actively engaged with their wider support network over an extended period of time in order to try to get our customer the support they needed. My colleagues have gone over and above what is expected, and they are all feeling the full impact of this tragic incident."
Hello, this is Caroline. Watch out, Dragon's Den. A St. Albans coffee shop owner has invented a clever gadget to help protect his customers from being infected with COVID-19. Gotts Cowell, who owns Cafe Roma in St. Peter Street, reopened selling takeaway coffee and pastries late last week. However, Gotts has gone the extra mile for customer safety and devised a unique device which avoids him and his staff coming into direct contact with the lids on takeaway cups. This gadget, which comprises a 3D printed casing holding a small fan, allows Gotts, hands-free, to pick up and place a plastic lid on the cup. He explained, "I weighed up the risk of continuing to trade as a takeaway only, but I couldn't think of a way of serving coffees and hot drinks in a takeaway cup without touching the lid of the cup when it was clicked into place. No one wants to drink out of a lid that has just been touched by somebody else. If I allowed the customer to put the lid on themselves, there could be spillages and scolding. So what to do? With the help of my neighbour and friend, Duncan Lutet, who volunteers for REMAP, a charity which custom makes equipment for disabled people, I found a solution. Suction was needed to lift the lid up, but then it needed to click into place on the cup. Duncan tried a turkey baster, but this didn't work, so with the help of a 3D printer, we came up with a gadget. It consists of a micro fan, which works to lift up the lid, so there's no direct contact with it, making it a safer way to customers to enjoy their drink." Customer Sally Audley said, "Sitting in or outside Cafe Roma is so sadly missed. Gotts serves the best coffee and Roma is a hub for so many of us. This part of the high street is deserted, and that Gotts has spent time, thought and expense to open safely during these unprecedented times is a mark of the affection he has for his customers. The invention is simply brilliant. It is so smooth. Perhaps that's where the future lies. But Gotts might need to work on a more catchy name for his innovative design, currently known as the Cup Lid Putteroner."
Hello, I'm Sarah. St Albans musician performs concert for neighbours from her tiny back garden. After her concerts were cancelled due to coronavirus pandemic, professional musician Leanne Sinner decided to put on a special concert for over 40 socially distancing neighbours from the confines of her tiny back garden in the city's conservation area. Surrounded by patio furniture, with her music sheets pegged in place on a stand to prevent them blowing away, and at times standing on a chair to see her audience, Leanne performed a variety of pieces over the course of 40 minutes. Pieces included There'll Be Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover, A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square, and It's a Long Way to Tipperary. The music was arranged by Adrian Bending, and the backing tracks were performed by the London Concert Orchestra Rhythm Section. The garden itself is the smallest in her road, measuring just 2 metres wide at the bottom. But because Leanne lives in the middle of 3 cul-de-sacs, it meant the concert reached a wide number of people. She was joined in her performance by 6-year-old daughter Emily, who danced around whilst her mum played, while toddler Charlotte, 18 months, had to be kept away from the assorted wires after managing to switch off the backing track at one point. Leanne has toured in over 80 different countries and performed at the Royal Albert Hall and Wigmore Hall. She appeared alongside Liam Gallagher on Jules Holland and has also taken part in a few Radio 1 Live Lounge performances. Her last couple of concerts this year were at the Royal Festival Hall and St Albans Cathedral, but she has had a few classical engagements cancelled, including a concert at Fairfield Halls and some classic Ibiza concerts this summer with Urban Soul Orchestra. Leanne said, "I've been playing with flautist neighbours most weeks after the NHS clap. It's become a bit of an occasion to see everyone, socially distanced of course, and to share some music. There's so much positive feedback about it, and we're all so close in our area anyway, that when I mentioned doing a little concert, I had lots of excited messages back. There are quite a few people in our area who live on their own, and I know they've been feeling lonely, despite it being a supportive and friendly neighbourhood. I thought it would be the perfect occasion to provide some background music to people enjoying picnic in their garden. As it turned out, lots of neighbours bought chairs and drinks and sat adjacent to my fence to listen. I decided to play my hornpipe encore perched on a chair at the end of my garden so I could see them all. It was a very special moment for me that, despite everything at the moment, we were all able to come together and to share an experience. Our future street party that we're planning, I'm sure, will be a very special occasion." Neighbours welcomed the performance. Liz Rose said, "The sound of a beautiful solo violin in the quiet and still Friday afternoon brought the whole neighbourhood together. From front gardens, back gardens, and chairs suitably distanced along the road, we were treated to a concert of World War II songs and music. How hard Leanne must have worked to ensure that the programme flowed. Hopefully the enthusiastic applause at the end demonstrated everyone's appreciation." Neil Hunt added, "That was terrific. Stood in our garden so couldn't see, but the sound was bright and clear. We even managed some singing."
Hello, I'm Ian. One charged and another arrested in Smallford attempted murder investigation. A 21-year-old man from Redbourne has been charged in connection with an attempted murder in Smallford. Police have been investigating a possible shooting which happened in Springfield Road on Tuesday, March the 24th. Officers were called shortly after 3 p.m. and, upon arrival at the scene, found a 37-year-old man with a wound to his abdomen. He was taken to hospital for treatment and was later discharged. An attempted murder investigation was launched by the Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire Major Crime Unit, and 2 people were arrested following a warrant in Redbourne on Wednesday last week. Michael Clark, aged 21, from Vare Meadows in Redbourne, has subsequently been charged with attempted murder and possession of a firearm. He was remanded into custody to appear before Hatfield Remand Court on Friday last week. A 16-year-old boy, arrested on suspicion of conspiracy to murder, has been released under investigation while inquiries continue. Detective Inspector Justine Jenkins, who is leading the investigation, said, We understand incidents such as this will cause concern amongst the local community. However, we quickly identified this is a targeted attack between people who are believed to be known to each other. Our inquiries are continuing at this time. Anyone with information who hasn't yet spoken to police is asked to please get in touch. Anyone with information is asked to email justine.jenkins@hearts.pnn.police.uk or call the non-emergency number 101, quoting Op Traverse.
Co-op burglary. The Co-op store in Redbourne was damaged during a suspected ram raid in the early hours of the morning. Police were called to the High Street store at 12:30 a.m. on May the 13th and discovered extensive damage to the front of the store. At the same time, two grey Toyota pickup trucks were seen leaving the area. Both drivers failed to stop when asked. The vehicles eventually stopped in Hatfield on a track near the A414 and the A1000 junction, and the occupants of both trucks left the scene. A police spokesman said, despite an extensive search of the area, including use of the police helicopter, they were not located and inquiries to trace them continue. The Toyotas have been recovered as part of the ongoing investigation. If you have information about this crime, you can report it online at hearts.police.uk/report or call our non-emergency number 101.
St Albans Primary Schools are open for learning and it's business as usual despite the lockdown. That's the message from head teachers across the city, who said while most children are not able to come into their school buildings at the moment, primary schools are most certainly open for business. Not only are teachers working extremely hard to provide meaningful and worthwhile home learning experiences for all pupils, they have also opened their doors to children of key workers and other eligible children, not just in term time, but during Easter and bank holidays when they have been needed. This week, primary heads from across St Albans met online to discuss their experiences of leading their schools through the challenging and ever-changing times of the COVID-19 lockdown. Using video conferencing technology, the St Albans Primary Heads Consortium shared the many creative ideas their schools are using to ensure that children's education continues, but also agreed parents have been doing a fantastic job as homeschool teachers, balancing their own workload with supporting the education of their children at home, making sure that any disruption to learning is kept to a minimum. Cunningham Hill Junior School head teacher Justin Elborn-Claude said, "We have been truly overwhelmed by how quickly our staff and children have adapted in these difficult times and are so grateful for the positivity we have received from our parents for all we are doing to keep children engaged, positive and learning whilst in lockdown." Justine even shared some of her fellow headteachers' thoughts on ITV News on Monday. Alex Lindley, head at Fleetville Infant School, said, "Heads aren't planning to reopen schools. In reality, they have never closed. We're just planning to adapt again." Following the announcement from the Prime Minister on Sunday, teachers now face months of changing provision on a day-to-day basis, responding to the gradual easing of rules regarding the lockdown. Cathy Longhurst, head at Mandeville Primary School, added, "Unfortunately, head teachers hear the news with everyone else in the government daily press briefings. We do not get advance notice to plan how to respond. We are very cautious about any plans to bring more children back into school and will only do so when we can be sure that safety measures are in place. It's such a challenging time for all of us, but the partnership between schools and families has never been stronger in St Albans."
And here are three short items. The first is headed Sustainable St Albans. Sustainable St Albans is running a competition for the under-18s to share how they're living sustainably under lockdown. The group is asking for children and teenagers to send in photos, artwork or pieces of writing inspired by their activities, such as riding bikes more, growing fruit and vegetables, cooking with leftovers and listening to birdsong. Sustainable St Albans has published an A to Z of eco-friendly activity suggestions on their website, following the cancellation of their planned festival, SustFest 20, due to the pandemic. The list also includes activities from the Hearts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust and from Wilderhood Watch in St Albans. Every entry will be entered into a prize draw, with five winners chosen at random to win a £15 gift voucher. Entries must be submitted by Friday, June the 5th. To enter, go to bit.ly/SSA lockdown comp. Marathon success. A St Albans primary school teacher has completed a marathon in the school field in aid of Hertfordshire's Down Syndrome charity. Bernard's Heath Junior School teacher, Trish Hall, has spent the last 5 months training for her first ever marathon, the Milton Keynes Full Marathon. As a result of the coronavirus outbreak, the event, which was set for May the 3rd, was cancelled. Having already received sponsorship in aid of Down Syndrome charity, Up on Downs, Trish was determined to complete the challenge. At 9 a.m. on Tuesday, May the 5th, Mrs. Hall started her run, cheered on by the children of key workers being looked after at the school. After running 104 laps of the school's running track, Mrs. Hall finally finished her marathon after 5 hours and 5 minutes, raising £2,000 for the charity that supports those with Down syndrome in Hertfordshire. To find out more about Up on Downs, go to upondowns.com. Audition success. Students at a St Albans school are set to begin online classes with the National Youth Theatre following successful auditions. Five pupils at Beaumont School are celebrating after taking part in the auditions which were hosted at the school. Jaya Barker, Luke Nixon, Jessica Payne, Chloe Prince and Rory Spencer, who all study drama at GCSE or A level, will be enrolled in the summer classes. Head of Drama, Lindsay Wallace, said, "We're proud of our ongoing relationship with the National Youth Theatre and the wonderful opportunities it offers our students. The audition process is valuable for all our students as they gain experience working with professional theatre makers. We're thrilled that we have such a large number of successful students this year. The lockdown has meant that National Youth Theatre has had to cancel its usual residential courses."
It's Mental Health Awareness Week, and a free helpline offering emotional support has been launched for staff and volunteers working in local community groups and charities during the pandemic. Local charity The Counselling Foundation has teamed up with St Albans District Council to run the initiative as part of Mental Health Awareness Week 2020. Clinical Director Jo Spilling said, "Listening is what we do, and we're honoured to be able to give something back and recognise the acts of kindness of volunteers and workers from across the community who've been supporting others during the pandemic. There are many reasons volunteers and workers may want to talk, including the pressures of helping others in distress during these challenging times, the difficulties of working in a home environment, concerns about health or the health and bereavement of those they're caring for, or simply wanting to talk to someone outside of friends and family. If you're working in a community or charity group, email helpline@counsellingfoundation.org. St Albans Cathedral has pledged its support for this year's Mental Health Awareness Week by illuminating the West End in turquoise. The Reverend Canon Abby Thompson, sub-dean, said, "Local charities such as It's OK to Say, Youth Talk and Hertfordshire Mind Network are facing unprecedented levels of need to access their services, and yet their funding streams are precarious. Please support their vital work in whatever way you can, and remember, no act of kindness is ever wasted." Stacey Turner from It's OK to Say added, "Research shows kindness and our mental health are deeply connected. The research shows that kindness is an antidote to isolation and creates a sense of belonging. I hope you take comfort in the turquoise illumination of the cathedral this week in honour of It's OK to Say and Mental Health Awareness Week, instilling calm and well-being. May you send love and light to those that need it, while acknowledging your own needs in a kind and mindful manner. And if there is distance between your connections, know it is just as meaningful.
Mental Health Week 2020. Moving forwards together during the uncertainty of coronavirus with It's Okay to Say by Stacey Turner. What is kindness? Tender kindness is motivated by a feeling of affection, the quality of being warm-hearted and considerate, humane, sympathetic and generous. The powerful act of kindness to oneself and others, no matter how small, is underrated for its bursts of value for happiness and well-being. The tiniest little offer of kindness sparks a glow and inspires. Research shows kindness and our mental health are deeply connected. Kindness is an antidote to isolation and creates a sense of belonging. We've witnessed this in abundance during COVID-19, as it helps reduce stress, brings a fresh perspective, and deepens friendships. Kindness to ourselves can prevent shame from corroding our sense of identity and to help boost our self-esteem. Kindness can even improve feelings of confidence and optimism. When one practices and accepts kindness, it's said that it promotes a feeling of being fully alive. The last 18 months have certainly been something for me personally. Two back-to-back surgeries, one major, two infections, one with complications and sepsis, not to mention coming to terms with my loss and climbing Kilimanjaro. I wouldn't recommend having major surgery and then climb a mountain in another country, but for me it was my salvation. Plus I had the support and sheer kindness that comes with every step that made it possible. Climbing Kilimanjaro is very much like facing and overcoming anxiety, with a descent back to base camp following the peak akin to the healing and recovery that we now all face during the COVID-19 crisis. While many will come through it without lasting negative effects, many face psychological harm and trauma from the disruption brought to our lives. Ambivalent is my word, mixed feelings about everything, as it all seems up in the air without certainties. But these mixed feelings are okay. Not long before lockdown, I was given the go-ahead to throw myself back into becoming the strong me again. And you can imagine how happy I felt. I felt free from the gripping time that had me stuck. I reached out to my sister, Stephanie Lawrence, in Brisbane, Australia. Stephanie is a dedicated and passionate personal trainer and nutritionist, a mental health champion who, from personal experience, connects it all together with an abundance of support. I've never felt closer to my sister. This connection is helping us to battle through, despite us being on opposite sides of the world. During my descent down to Kili, I slid and fell, and it's still a blur. When I couldn't go on through absolute exhaustion, I reached out where at one point I was carried. I wish I could show you a video of the bunch of guides surrounding me on the lower part approaching the camp. They stayed so close until I collapsed into my tent. Throughout all this uncertainty, I understand how fragile life may seem, where once you were stronger, now feel wobbly, dealing with the loss and range of emotions and hurt. It's helpful to have self-compassion, to be kind to yourself and to others with little expectation. I need to do this, but it's okay if I don't do it right now. You may find it helpful to reach out. Maintaining connection together makes for a better. Think about how you can slowly weave yourself in and become part of and forming some of the social fabric that's in our everyday that we depend upon. Kindness develops community. And if there's distance between your connections, know that it's just as meaningful. Visit www.itsokaytosay.org.uk for further reading.
Hearts Police has credited teams of PCSOs and volunteers with reduction in crime across the county. In St Albans, crime was down by 11% in March 2020 compared to March 2019. The force said its safer neighbourhood teams were a key part of identifying and tackling emerging crime trends. The force has also seen a slight increase in officer numbers, At the end of March 2019, it had 1,981 officers compared to 2,045 at the start of March 2020, an increase of just over 3%. It said, "It is difficult to attribute peaks and troughs in crime to any one specific cause, but we have a variety of different options and resources available to us, and to help reduce crime, catch criminals, and help keep people safe. Hertfordshire has retained strong local safer neighbourhood teams who are able to identify and swiftly tackle issues that require specific local action."
Harpenden Town Football Club calls on sports clubs to support hospice. Members of Harpenden Town FC are putting their spare time off the pitch to good use by raising much-needed funds for Rennie Grove Hospice Care. They will be covering 926 miles, either on foot or by bike, to show their support for the local hospice care charity. 926 miles is the distance from their club to the other 20 football grounds in the Spartan South Midlands Premier Division, including London Coney FC, Coney Heath FC, and Leverstock Green FC. They hope to raise £1,000 for Rennie Grove. Club chairman Roman Moitzak explained, "As a football club, we are part of the community, and we want to give back in some way. It has been a tradition since I have been involved with the club that for the final game of the season, we give the gate proceeds from our final home match to a charity, and this season it would have been Rennie Grove. We would hope to get the 926 miles done between us by the end of May." He added, "To other sports clubs, why not follow our example and get all of your members who are out there completing other exercise activities to club together and complete all of those activities for worthwhile purpose?" Claire Redrup, Community and Events Fundraising Manager at Rennie Grove, said, "We are so grateful to Roman and everyone at Harpenden Town FC who is taking on this epic challenge for Rennie Grove. Our hospice at home nurses are working tirelessly in West Harts and Bucks to care for patients and their families. We need to raise £20,000 per day in order to keep our vital services available to local patients and their families, so any support from the community is hugely appreciated." She continued, "If your sports team feels inspired by Harpenden Town FC and would like to take on a challenge too, our fundraising team will be on hand to support you. Please email community@renniegrove.org or call 01442 890222.
This next article is accompanied by three colourful pictures of children absolutely beaming as they're riding and scooting and cycling along. It's entitled, "Meet Our Small But Mighty Fundraisers." Young fundraisers have been using their free time to take part in various sponsored events in aid of good causes. The enforced lockdown has prompted local school children to use their daily exercise slots for the benefit of charities. Mia, Ray and Ava Scullard were inspired by Captain Tom Moore's efforts to do their bit for NHS Charities Together, joining with their friends from Praywood Primary School to complete enough miles to cover the distance from St Albans in Hertfordshire to St Albans, West Virginia. They can complete the 3,869.70 miles by walking, biking, running and scooting each day until they reach their destination and have got a fundraising target of £1,000. Mum Catherine said, "We thought this challenge would not only raise some money for a very important cause, not just in the current climate, but also to help achieve this goal. Most of the children that are currently signed up to the challenge are from reception in year one, and as one of their teachers said, they may be small, but they are mighty." Beaumont school pupils Florence Tatlock and Erin Mill took part in a sponsored cycle around Clarence Park as part of the 2.6 challenge. They cycled round 26 times, the equivalent of 26 miles, for St Albans and District Food Bank. Mum Jo said, "The food bank is in desperate need for help at these challenging times, and any one of us could need its support, so they deemed it a good cause. They kept their social distance and various friends and family popped by in the 3.5 hours it took them to do it, to offer their support. They've so far raised £627, which is brilliant." 6-year-old Archer Hawkey, a year one pupil at Crabtree Infants, has also been fundraising. Mum Catherine explained, "After taking part in Clap for Carers, Archer decided he wanted to help raise money for the NHS to thank them for all their brave hard work. He decided to set himself the challenge of running as many kilometres as possible in one school week and asking people to sponsor him. He ran 15.75 kilometres in the week across four runs.
The next article is taken from MP Daisy Cooper's Westminster Diary. New government guidance sparked a lively public debate on whether or how some people should be asked to return to work, especially while the test, trace and isolate strategy was still unclear. Soon after, private conversations on whether or when MPs should be asked to physically return to the chamber also spilled out onto the pages of the press. The Leader of the House announced that MPs should set an example and return to Parliament from June the 2nd. But the Speaker was quick to remind the Leader, who was top dog, replying that he would suspend Parliament if social distancing rules were breached. The Speaker also warned that if MPs returned to physical voting instead of using the newly established online voting, they would take much longer than usual, probably around 30 minutes and possibly up to an hour, to ensure that social distancing can be observed. You know you've stepped through the looking glass when some MPs are still contemplating ditching the quick and simple digital method for an hour-long shuffle of voting with your feet. First, there is the safety of MPs and clerks. Some MPs are older, shielding, pregnant, or more vulnerable to COVID-19 by virtue of being black, Asian, or from an ethnic minority. But there's also a strong argument for efficiency. By my calculation, the cost to the taxpayer of 650 MPs taking an hour to vote comes to around £25,000, more than enough to pay for a newly qualified nurse, and that's before taking the time of the parliamentary staff into account. Centenary Action Group, the UK's largest coalition of women's rights activists and organisations, also called on Parliament to lead by example, but to do so by recognising that those with caring responsibilities, childcare responsibilities, or who have family members who are shielding, those who rely on public transport, and those who are shielding themselves, may not be able to return to the workplace. While the government is not publishing its scientific and medical advice in full, it will be difficult for the public to trust that it is safe to go back to work or school. I will continue my calls for greater transparency so we can all work together to get past this crisis.
And now Rob is here with a few words from our other local MP, Harpenden and Hitchin's Bim Afolami.
And the headline is Backing Our Local Businesses During the Coronavirus Lockdown. And Bim Afolami says, I've been working hard to support local businesses in Harpenden who've been impacted by coronavirus. The best way for individuals to help local businesses survive this difficult period is to continue to use them. You can find out what businesses are still open by having a look at online directories compiled by local champions. For those in and around Harpenden, you can find this information on www.harpendendirectory.co.uk or visit the Harpendia website www.harpendia.com/shopping, where Ron Taylor has put together a mini directory for the high street retailers that have adjusted by moving their business online. I urge you all to take a look and continue to shop locally. We must all do our bit to ensure that we protect and preserve our wonderful high streets amid the coronavirus pandemic. The government has made a huge amount of support available for our high street businesses with measures such as the Coronavirus Job Retention Scheme, Small Business Rates Relief, or Business Loan Schemes. However, the coronavirus outbreak has had a considerable impact on our local businesses and high streets, with many having been forced to close and others operating at a significantly reduced capacity. As your local MP, I've worked with the local councillors, colleagues in Parliament and officials at HM Treasury to try and develop a way to make sure money gets to the local businesses that need it in a timely fashion, and that those who've fallen between the cracks of the government scheme receive the support they need to survive this crisis. This has now become a reality as the Treasury has confirmed that councils will be able to use excess grant funding to support small local businesses. The minister who implemented the changes, Simon Clark MP, said that my, quote, initiative and passion to give local councils more flexibility to help deserving local businesses has been hugely important and appreciated, end of quotes. This new measure will allow councils to provide grants of up to £10,000 or £25,000 to support additional local businesses. Many of them need it desperately, and the money can start to be given to businesses from this week. I look forward to working with our local councils to ensure that Harpenden's businesses can get the help they need.
And finally, a story about a rather remarkable little girl.
2-year-old raises funds for homeless charity. A 2-year-old girl has become one of the district's youngest fundraisers after walking 2.6 kilometres for a local homeless charity. Lily Gray Linnell took part in the 2.6 challenge, organised in place of the cancelled London Marathon, on behalf of Emmaus Hertfordshire, and has so far raised £781 in support. She started her efforts with a social media video asking people to help her help the homeless, in which she said, "Hello everybody, my name's Lily. On Sunday, I'm going to walk really far to raise money for the homeless. Please sponsor me any money you can spare. Thank you, love Lily." Emmaus are currently housing and supporting 31 formerly homeless people, but since lockdown has seen a 70% loss in income. This has put an immense strain on daily operations, while they're also trying to shield formerly homeless residents from the virus. Despite these ongoing pressures, the charity has been supporting local food banks with their vans, delivering emergency furniture packages to those housed by the local authority, and even providing items for hospitals. This included joining Harpenden Round Table to collect donated food from people's driveways and doorsteps on behalf of St Albans and District Food Bank. The charity is currently looking at ways that they can protect their volunteers, staff and customers when their 5 second-hand furniture shops can open. This includes installing screens at till points, spacing stock, creating one-way systems, and with quarantine donated items, they're displayed on the shop floor. The charity will soon reopen their eBay store in a reduced capacity to ensure safety for staff and volunteers. Emmaus is preparing for an increase in homelessness as the impacts of COVID-19 stuns the economy. They've received an essential donation of 10 face shields to be used in emergency situations in their residential building as they take in homeless people in need of accommodation. With far greater need for PPE in the NHS and care homes, Emmaus held off ordering stock and has relied on donations instead.
Now, here are some suggestions for radio listening during the coming week, starting with Saturday, May 23rd. A radio version of the quiz show, A Question of Sport, has team captains Phil Tufnell and Matt Dawson, each joined by one guest. It's at 2 p.m. on Radio 5 Live. If you have digital radio and can get Radio 4 Extra, Georgette Heyer fans may like to tune in to a dramatisation of her book, Friday's Child, at 4 p.m. on Saturday. The opera on 3 this week is a recording of a performance at Glyndebourne in 2010 of Humperdinck's opera Hansel and Gretel, 6:30 p.m. Radio 3. In The Poet Laureate Has Gone to His Shed, Simon Armitage talks to fellow poet Jackie Kay at 7:15, Radio 4. Then at 10:15 on Radio 4, Grounded with Louis Theroux. Louis is in conversation with actress Helena Bonham Carter. Moving on to Sunday, May 24th, and at 8:10 in the morning on Radio 4, Sunday Worship has reflections on living well during this time of waiting and staying positive in a period of continued uncertainty. There's comedy at just after midday with another chance to hear I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue, with Victoria Wood joining regulars Tim Brooke Taylor, Barry Cryer and Graham Garden on Radio 4. There's more comedy for fans of PG Woodhouse with an episode from Leave It to Smith called Imposters at Blandings with Martin Jarvis as Lord Emsworth. 3 p.m. on Radio 4. Choral Evensong at 3 p.m. on Radio 3 comes from Christchurch Cathedral, Oxford, and was recorded in May 2016. While at 5:30 on Radio 3, Words and Music is an episode inspired by the saving for the nation of the Kent beachside home of film director Derek Jarman. Tilda Swinton and Samuel Barnett are the readers, with reflections that reference Jarman's work. The drama on Radio 3 is an adaptation of the Tony Award-winning play Copenhagen by Michael Frayen, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, Simon Russell Beale and Greta Scacchi. The subject is the controversial meeting between physicist Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg in 1941. Bohr and his wife Marguerite live in Nazi-occupied Denmark, and their visitor Heisenberg is German. These two old friends are now on opposing sides, but between them they have the ability to change the course of history. That's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. on Sunday. Now looking at those programmes which are broadcast at the same time every day, Monday to Friday, starting with Monday the 25th of May. It's a bank holiday this week. The book of the week is Diary of a Young Naturalist, in which Northern Irish 15-year-old Dara McNulty, who first came to notice when he filed reports for Countryfile, reads from his own book Charting Wildlife. Dara gives us not only an extraordinary poetic sense of his engagement, but also an insight into how a deep connection with nature has supported him through the times when he was bullied for being autistic. It's on every day, on Radio 4 at 9:45 a.m. and repeated at 12:30 midnight. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 a.m. on Radio 4 is A Run in the Park by David Park, about a group of strangers in Belfast forming a running group. At 10:45 a.m. on Radio 3 you can hear The Essay, which this week features diarists including Robert Louis Stevenson, Dorothy Wordsworth and Christopher Isherwood, among others. The Composer of the Week at 12 noon on Radio 3, each day, don't forget, Rachmaninoff. And just after midday on Radio 4, every day, Monday to Friday, Martin Jarvis performs five of Richmel Crompton's ever-popular Just William stories, under the title Just William Pursuing Happiness. I know my mum will be particularly pleased with that one. The Great Post Office Trial explores the period in the early 2000s when, after the introduction of a new computer system, the Post Office began using its data to accuse sub-postmasters of falsifying accounts and stealing money. It's been described as one of the worst miscarriages of justice in UK legal history. Programme hears from those whose lives were shattered and follows the twists and turns of a David and Goliath courtroom battle. It's on Radio 4 at 1:45 p.m. Again, every day, Monday to Friday. We must mention at 7 p.m. on Radio 4, after having to rely on repeated episodes for a while due to the current lockdown, The Archers has found a way of recording in the actors' own homes and returns with new episodes this week. Bit like what we're doing on the Talking Newspaper. Well done, The Archers. And Book of Bedtime at 10:45 p.m. on Radio 4 is John McGann's classic novel Among Women, about family life in rural Ireland in the middle of the 20th century. So we now move on to the individual programmes you can hear through the week, again starting on Bank Holiday Monday, May 25th. At 9:30 a.m. you can join a homeschool history lesson on Florence Nightingale on Radio 4. Radio 3 has Bark Walks at 2 p.m. In 1705, the 20-year-old Johann Sebastian Bach set off from his home in Arnstadt to walk 250 miles to Lübeck to meet his hero, the composer and organist Dietrich Buxtehude. This is an omnibus edition of writer Horatio Clare's series of five slow radio walks, searching for Bach's footsteps and his ghost in the field and woods of central and northern Germany. at 2:45 p.m. on Radio 4, we have 2,000 years of puzzling about the history of puzzles, starting with mazes. In the second of three parts of Tales from the Stave at 4 p.m. on Radio 4, Clemency Burton Hill examines the manuscript and several items of theatrical memorabilia, telling the story of the official debut of Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance. And to finish the day, tune in, by royal appointment, to Classic FM from 8 p.m. to a very special new presenter. His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales will be presenting two special shows on his love of classical music and focusing on the work of certain orchestras. Prince Charles will be joined by Alan Titchmarsh for 2 hours on Monday and then present his own show the following evening, so the Tuesday. It's Prince Charles on Classic FM, 8 till 10 p.m, Monday and Tuesday evening. Staying with Tuesday, May 26th, a little earlier in the day, at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, from our home correspondent has dispatches from journalists and writers around the UK. That's followed at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 by The Every Woman, in which novelist Sarah Hall goes in search of a universal female literary character as she examines the native tradition in literature of the everyman character, who is generally male. Costing the Earth on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. wonders whether tree planting could really reduce our emissions and asks whether natural regeneration and nurturing existing woodlands would be a better policy. And over on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. there's music by Handel in a performance in the Barbican recorded on May 2018, including Zadok the Priest. On Wednesday, May 27th, at 9 a.m. on Radio 4, More or Less investigates the numbers that are present everywhere, in the news, in politics, and in life generally. It's followed by Legacy of War, looking at how the shadow of war falls long and wide, not just on veterans and victims of conflict, but also on subsequent generations. It focuses on Kurt Marx, who came to the UK on a Kinder transport. His wife Ingrid survived 3 years in Auschwitz. Their son Michael speaks about the pressures of growing up with deeply traumatised parents and his fears that the trauma will have been passed on to his daughter, Johanna. At 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated at 8:45 p.m. At 2:15 on Radio 4 in the afternoon, you can hear the third of five parts of The Unforgiven, a radio prequel to the hit series Waking the Dead, featuring Holly Aird, Sue Johnston and Claire Goose. On Thursday, May 28th, Free Thinking at 10 a.m. on Radio 3 gives another chance to hear Poet Laureate Simon Armitage in conversation with writer and former Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams at the 2018 Hay Festival. At 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4, the Radio Times Choice has the intriguing title Night Fights Giant Snail, examining the images found in the margins of many medieval manuscripts, which can be sometimes saintly and beautiful, but sometimes playful and bizarre. There's the second of two Rumpole dramas at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4, an episode called Rumpole and the Eternal Triangle, starring Timothy West as the older Rumpole and Benedict Cumberbatch as his younger self. A beautiful violinist asks the barrister to defend her husband, who's been accused of murdering one of her admirers. It's followed at 3 p.m. by Ramblings, in which Claire Balding revisits some of the best moments from her favourite walks. And in a new series of The Bottom Line, at 8:30 p.m. on Radio 4, Evan Davis asks, is 2020 the new year zero for the economy? He looks at whether the economic challenges ahead are as serious as those faced after the Second World War in 1945, dubbed Year Zero. So to Friday, May 29th, nearly the end of another month. In the second of four parts of the Charles Paris mystery, A Doubtful Death, Simon Brett's comic crime tale, Charles, played by Bill Nighy, is in Oxford, appearing in a reimagining of Hamlet, when the actress playing Ophelia goes missing. It's at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4. At 2:15pm on Radio 4, Personal Shopper is a topical drama about how living in enforced isolation can lead to the forging of new relationships, as 14-year-old Max offers to shop for some self-isolating neighbours. Radio 3 in concert at 7:30pm has a performance of Bach's Mass in B minor from the surroundings of Bath Abbey, first broadcast in 2018. Finally, Tony Blackburn's Golden Hour is always a relaxing way to end the week as he plays pop and soul across the decades. It's on Radio 2 at 8pm. And as ever, may I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts Advertiser. Wings in the dark, the secret migration of birds at night. It all started with a tweet, not a real bird tweet, but a tweet on the social media app Twitter. It read, "Well, blow me down, two groups of common scoter heard calling in the dark from my back garden at 9:31pm and 9:37pm. And there it was, like a line cast to a waiting fish, a simple message from a nearby fellow birder, and I was hooked. I rushed outside, it now being quite late and completely dark, and after a nervous wait with ears bent to the skies, at 10:50pm, I picked out the calls of my first flocks of common scoters flying north over my garden. It's difficult to describe the thrill, in part made up of the knowledge that these were sea ducks, spending the winter in huge rafts of thousands off our coasts, the last bird I would expect to record over my garden. In part two, the excitement came from the sense of a new door being opened in my birding experience. If this most unlikely of birds was flying over on an early April evening, what else might also be chancing it over my suburban patch? This is the question at the heart of a growing new trend in that ancient hobby of birdwatching. Known as NOCMIG, short for nocturnal migration, an increasing number of birdwatchers are becoming nighttime listeners too, as the sheer variety of bird life moving over our gardens at night becomes revealed. In many ways, it is nothing new and should really be obvious. If thousands of birds that were in the south suddenly appear in the north, and we didn't see them move, then logically they must have done so at night. However, what is new is that more and more people are recording these movements, and with access to better technology and social media, are able to quickly share and confirm their findings. With the first report of common scoters flying over Hadfield in Derbyshire on the 31st of March, a huge and spontaneous citizen science project was sparked. Over a period of 4 nights, hundreds of people across the UK reported hearing scoters flying over their gardens in the dark. This allowed a basic mapping of the scoters' movement on a scale not achieved before, and gives a significant insight into the movement of thousands of these birds northwards over our country at this time of year. Of course, it's not just scoters that migrate at night. Many people will have heard the thin, seep calls of redwing, a small thrush on winter's nights as they return to the UK from their Scandinavian breeding grounds. Since first going out to listen to the scoters, I have added 11 new species to my garden bird list, among them migrating waders such as whimbrel and oystercatcher, but also some local birds, ducks, moorhens, coots, and even a little grebe. All these birds I've heard quite clearly as they navigate their way in the dark, but many birders are taking it a step further and actually recording the sounds over their house at night. This, of course, allows them not to be present and to simply analyse the recordings the following day. As a result, there is a whole new body of data building as to the variety and number of birds flying overhead at night. It turns out that moorhens, coots and little grebes move around quite a lot, or at least they are very noisy when they do so. Of course, it helps if you're already familiar with these birds' daytime calls, and most of the time they sound pretty similar at night. However, many birds do have specifically nocturnal calls, and that is where it can help to listen to others' recordings to identify what you heard. Inevitably, it is never possible to identify every sound, and I have a growing list of unknown calls. Who knows, some of them might even be the local cat. What is clear is that never before has there been a better time to explore this new frontier of birdwatching. With fewer trains and planes, quieter roads and streets, sitting outside at night under the stars has become more peaceful and tranquil than ever. If you find yourself unable to sleep one night, give it a go. You may not hear any birds, but I'm sure it will be therapeutic.
Hello, I'm Sue. This is a story from Hertfordshire Life magazine. It's called Reimagining Churches. For 50 years, the Churches Conservation Trust has been working to ensure redundant churches remain an asset to their communities. It's by Ellie Fells. Churches are part of the fabric of our towns and cities, the markers of centuries-long period when church-going and religion formed the building blocks of day-to-day life. Since the onset of the First World War, changes in English society have meant the importance of religion has lessened for many. Rural villages emptied as men were called to wars and industry moved to bigger places. Churches in these areas particularly suffered as their congregations dwindled. By the 1960s, many had fallen into a state of abandonment and disrepair, and, despite their historical significance, protecting these buildings was often seen as a hindrance to development rather than a benefit. It was in response to this that the Redundant Churches Fund, now Churches Conservation Trust, was created in 1969. It was a unique partnership between church, state, and charity that meant an official body would take responsibility for these important buildings. Since then, more than 350 churches, including four in Hertfordshire, Oxey Chapel, Watford, St Mary's, Little Hormead, St Andrew's, Buckland, and St James's in Stansted Abbots, have been vested in its care by the Church of England, with the Trust working not only to protect and restore these ancient structures, but to ensure they continue to be enjoyed. This year marks the Trust's 50th birthday, with various events taking place across the country in celebration. All the churches in the Trust's care are listed, with many being either Grade 1 listed or scheduled ancient monuments that date back to the medieval period. Anthony Bennett, Director of Development at CCT, says, "These buildings are an integral physical record of English rural and parish life over thousands of years. With their paintings, stained glass windows and architecture, churches are museums without walls," Anthony says. "Landmarks that offer a fascinating insight into our history in a way that few other buildings can. To ensure they remain that way, the Trust carries out extensive conservation projects, from fitting new lead roofs to restoring one of England's earliest oak doors. While rescuing and restoring the buildings in its care has been and continues to be a major focus, the work at CCT today is as much about rejuvenation. Central to this approach is ensuring that these buildings continue to be used by the people around them. Churches are intended to be places for community and gathering," Anthony says, "and the buildings themselves can host diverse purposes. The charity has a dedicated regeneration team that works to find new use projects for these versatile spaces when they're no longer needed primarily for worship. A particularly successful project was at St Mary at the Quay in Ipswich. We partnered up with the charity Mind UK and have repurposed the space as a drop-in centre for mental health care and mindfulness," Anthony explains. "It's also used for conferences, but it remains available as a place of worship too." He notes that the use of the space in this way isn't necessarily anything new. Churches have always been spaces for contemplation and reflection, so in a sense, what we're doing is putting new wine into old bottles. Due to the changing demographic, the Muslim population in its vicinity, All Souls in Bolton, has become redundant. But as a result of the work of the CCT, it has transformed into a number of different units that cater to the needs of those living nearby, including a doctor's surgery, a start-up space for businesses, and a cafeteria. It's been so successful, and it's great to see the space being used by lots of different faith groups for different purposes, Anthony reflects. Half a century on from its formation, the Churches Conservation Trust has changed the face of declining, disused religious buildings. Its conservation work has enabled the history of these fascinating buildings to live on, while also breathing much-needed new life into their walls too. These buildings now host an eclectic range of events each year, from concerts to gin nights, opening their doors to people from all walks of life, regardless of their beliefs. Thanks to the Trust, in hundreds of places, churches are once again a vital asset at the heart of communities. Events will be held across the country to mark the Church's Conservation Trust's 50th anniversary. For details and for more on Hearts Churches, go to visitchurches.org.uk.
Hello, I'm Bill. The story I'm going to read from Hearts Life today is called Around the World on a Penny Farthing. It says that this month, 135 years ago, a Berkhamsted-born grocer set off on a world first to circumnavigate the globe by bicycle. It's written by Heather Harris. Socks, a spare shirt, a raincoat that doubled as a tent, a bedroll and a small pocket revolver. A checklist that could belong to your average teenager heading off on a Duke of Edinburgh expedition. Well, minus the firearm. But these were the essentials of a trip rather more arduous than a week in the Lake District. Thomas Stevens was embarking on a transcontinental journey across America on a penny farthing in 1884. No lightweight fiberglass aerodynamic superbike for this Berkhamsteadian. His was a 50-inch black-enameled Columbia Standard bicycle with nickel-plated wheels and a handlebar bag. The whole contraption weighed nearly 60 pounds, considerably more than the British Olympic cycling team's entire current fleet. The high wheeler also had no gears, prompting its manufacturers, Pope Bicycle Company, to admit a rider needed strong leg muscles and vigorous pedalling to propel the vehicle up the smallest of hills. Going downhill could be even more hazardous. And Thomas was no athlete. He was born on Castle Street in Berkhamsted on Christmas Eve, 1854. And after leaving Bourne's charity school in the town, he became an apprentice grocer. Emigrating to America with his family in 1871, Tom worked at the Wyoming Railroad Mill. Here a maverick approach to life made its first appearance. He was run out of town for importing British labourers in exchange for part of their salaries. It was after moving to San Francisco that he first got a taste for the craze of cycling. Its popularity due to a new focus on safety measures such as a seat and a brake, which you jammed into the solid rubber of the giant wheel beneath you. And he decided to tackle what seemed like an impossible journey. As the 1884 edition of Harper's Weekly magazine reported, seven men had all attempted the same feat, but the great difficulties encountered in crossing 1,500 miles of rocky mountain, barren deserts and bridgeless streams between California and the Missouri River had invariably turned them back. Undeterred, our intrepid Hertfordshire hero, using the small step projecting from the rear wheel, mounted his penny farthing at 8 a.m. on April 22nd, 1884, and began what was to be 103.5 days in the saddle. Describing this great wheelman, Adventure Cyclist magazine said, he was a man of medium height, wearing an oversized blue flannel shirt over blue overalls, which were tucked into a pair of leggings at the knee, and he was tanned as a nut. A moustache protruded from his face. So, no lycra or helmet emblazoned with sponsorship. In fact, no helmet at all. This was a risky oversight, as even the most experienced riders had what they called headers, flying over the handlebars, which, with the seat at near head height, were sometimes fatal. His journey took him from Sacramento through the Sierra Nevada mountains to Nevada, Utah, and Wyoming, at an average speed of 12 to 14 miles an hour, although more than a third of the route had to be walked, pushing or carrying his trusty ordinary. As Harper's Weekly reported, he followed the old California trail across the plains and mountains, astonishing the Indians and meeting with many strange adventures. These included close shaves with snakes, a mountain lion and bears, crossing high passes and riding around the poolroom tables of a Nevada bar. After 83 days of traveling, 20 days stoppage for wet weather, and 3,700 miles, he reached Boston at 2 p.m. on August 4, 1884, to complete the first transcontinental bicycle ride. But Tom was not content with this record. After sending some reports of his trip to Outing, a cycling magazine, they made him a special correspondent and sent him to England. Here he announced his intention to continue his route, this time to circumnavigate the world. Several hundred watched his departure on May 4, 1885, from Edgehill Church in Liverpool. He wrote, "A small sea of hats is enthusiastically waved aloft. A ripple of applause escaped from 500 English throats as I mount my glistening bicycle, and merrily we wheel down Edge Lane and out of Liverpool." Within minutes, of course, it began raining. He passed through his birthplace and recorded in his journal, "Spending the night in Berkhamsted, Hertfordshire, I pull out towards London on Thursday morning." He commented that the roads in England were better than in America. Well, how times have changed. After reaching the south coast, he embarked on a ferry from Newhaven to Dieppe, from France into Germany and then on to Austria and Hungary. Mostly cycling alone, he reported his joy at being joined in Hungary by a fellow long-distance cyclist, who, despite not speaking a word of English, proved welcome companionship. Then it was on to Slavonia, Serbia, Bulgaria, and Rumelia, before arriving in Constantinople to complete the European leg of his journey. After changing his spokes and buying a better pistol, he set off to conquer Asia, pedaling through Anatolia, Armenia, Kurdistan, Iraq, and Iran. Having been denied permission to travel through Siberia, he headed instead for Afghanistan. Arriving on March 10, 1886, he was immediately expelled. Forced to return to Turkey, he was determined not to give up and instead booked himself and his bicycle on a Russian steamer for India. Reporting his exploits, a newspaper of the time states, "In the Red Sea, his knowledge of mules was useful to the British Army." But oddly doesn't explain how or why. "Excellent wheeling and free from bandits," is how Thomas described his hot and pleasant cycle along the Grand Trunk Road before he boarded a steamer from Calcutta to Hong Kong and southern China. A Chinese official had to give him refuge from rioters. He was delighted to finally arrive in the calm and beautiful country of Japan. On December 17, 1886, in Yokohama, he dismounted. "Distance actually wheeled about 13,500 miles," was the final entry in his travelogue. The same travelogue was expanded to a two-volume book of 1,000 pages titled Around the World on a Bicycle. Reprinted as the one volume Around the World on a Penny Farthing, the original volumes will set you back around £600. Hanging up his bicycle clips for good, Thomas gave his history-making bicycle back to the Pope Company, who preserved it for visitors to its factory until the Second World War. Sadly, it was then donated for scrap to support the war effort. Stevens, however, soon got itchy feet, and in 1890 arranged with the New York Times to pay him to join the search in East Africa for the explorer Henry Morton Stanley, the man who had found David Livingstone, only to then go missing himself. After a six-month expedition with characteristic understatement, Thomas wrote in his column, "I had gratified a pardonable journalistic ambition in being the first correspondent to reach Stanley and to give him news of the world after his long period of African darkness." Finally, he decided it was time to settle down. He returned to England and married Frances Barnes, the widowed mother of two famous English actresses. Still drawn to the limelight, however, he became business manager of the Garrick Theatre in London. He died on January 24, 1935, aged 80. You have to pedal forward more than a century after Thomas's exploits, to Valentine's Day 2008, for the next high-profile attempt to circumnavigate the globe by bicycle. Scotsman Mark Beaumont cycled 18,032 miles in 78 days, 14 hours and 40 minutes. But he did have gears, brakes that worked, and a bike with two wheels the same size. We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our many contributors, Julie, Ian, Sue, Caroline, Hilary, Rob and Sarah, and of course Rupert for the Nature Notes and John for the radio listings. Steve will be here next week with News Extra, but that's all from me in May 2020. We close with 40 Miles by Dan Raza. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now and stay safe. Sweet mama now. And in the moonlight, the wildcats howl. And I've run so long that I've forgotten where I'm bound. Sweet mama now.
Oh,